Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. There's a lot of talk around gut health in the media, the idea that the health of this organ holds the key to your overall health, and it's something that we need to take great care in cultivating. But because there's a lot to talk about, there are a lot of mixed messages about what you can do to ensure good gut health. And so today, my co-founder, Dr. Kiara Hunt, and I are talking to Dr. Neil Shah, a paediatric gastroenterologist. Neil, thank you very much for joining us. So just to clarify, for us sort of non-medical lay people, a gastroenterologist, or the name gastroenterologist, I can hardly pronounce it. It's a bit confusing. What is exactly that you do?
So I'm a paediatric gastroenterologist, so I look after children's gut problems from any age from 0 to 16, basically.
And you work at Great Ormond Street, don't you?
Yeah, so I work at Great Ormond Street and Portland Hospital, my two little bases, and that's what I've been doing for many years now.
And I'm a GP, and Neil sees a lot of my patients who I can't quite work out. So what is it that people mean when we talk about gut health? What is this concept?
So if you're a gastroenterologist, you're probably at your most exciting time, because finally people have started to think about the gut as being the key organ for everything in terms of long-term health. So gut health is important for aging, it's for cardiovascular disease, it's important for obesity, it's important for allergies, actually. It's important for almost every future aspect of your children, not just when they're young, but when they're older as well.
And we've started to know and understand a lot more about the gut in recent years, and the whole concept of good bacteria in the gut and our own microbiome, which is personal to our bodies, is something that when I was at medical school, certainly no one was talking about.
So you can't go to a medical meeting and someone not talk about a microbiome. There are about a trillion bacteria sitting in your gut and your gums. There's more DNA, there's more metabolism, more metabolites, and all these products sitting in your gut that influence almost everything that's going to happen. And you only have about 1,000 days in your lifetime to influence that unique pattern. So that's in pregnancy, antenatally, and the first 2 years of your child's life. And that sets you for the rest of your life.
And that's amazing. And so, you know, mothers are often asking me about what can I do to improve my child's gut health? When is it important to start? So you're saying as early as pregnancy with that child is important.
Yeah, so we begin to worry about what happens antenatally, how your child is born, yeah, and the way your child's born, the role of antibiotics, how we feed our children, breastfeeding being the best choice throughout. And then if you can then influence that and regulate it, it's going to influence your child's health for the rest of their life. So yeah, your first 1,000 days is absolutely fundamental.
And is there anything you can do already sort of in pregnancy before the child is born?
So we're still learning. We're in a learning phase, and the learning is rapid at the moment. Yeah. And what we're really beginning to understand that different bugs, it's not about one bug, it's about profiles of bacteria, not forgetting there are fungi in there, they're viruses, and there's a whole combination
of good ones.
Yeah. And that's what we call the microbiome. But it's a pattern which almost is unique to each one of us, and we can influence those patterns, and those patterns sometimes start off badly. So that's called dysbiosis, or a bad bacterial pattern, and we want to learn to influence those.
So what can make it start off badly? Is that just bad luck or...?
No, so things like born by cesarean section. If you're born naturally and vaginally for a normal birth, then your microbiome pattern of your child is usually your child's gut is encountering infant bacteria that are immature. Your immune system's very immature when you're young, and it's not going to overreact. If you're born by C-section, you're liable to be born with bacteria that are adult type and your immune system can't cope. So that's dysbiosis. And it's, you know, it's the reason why we've now seen the emergence of new diseases that are autoimmune diseases, non-infectious types of problems, you know, diabetes, all these conditions that previously we probably didn't encounter because our gut was encountering infections and busy dealing with those rather than dealing with, you know, things that are not dangerous, but our bodies are starting to recognise them inappropriately as being dangerous.
And obviously, you know, how we're born is something that our parents or we can often not influence. It's often out of parents' hands. So just being born by C-section doesn't mean that your child's going to have a bad gut biome for the rest of its life. As you said, it's the first 2 years essentially of the child's life, and pregnancy that is a big influencer. So
yes.
What can they, I mean, breastfeeding you talked about.
I mean, so antenatally, people are starting to discuss the role of probiotics in mothers last trimester.
When you're pregnant.
So if you're at least on some good probiotics that are safe, then probably you reduce the risk of allergies like eczema and skin conditions. But again, there's not a huge amount of evidence out there at the moment. More importantly, if you are born and you have a higher risk group, so cesarean sections, early antibiotics, using good bacteria that is, you know, safe and good to give your babies, is probably going to be of benefit, not just for the short term, but for the long term as well.
So you're talking probiotics?
Yeah, I am. So there are different classes of probiotics, and remembering that each probiotic contains a whole array of different bacteria. Yeah, and you'll hear names like Acidophilus, Lactobacilli, Bifidobacteria. These are all the long names that doctors use. But it's the combination that makes the difference.
And can people buy that in are those the ones you see on the pharmacy shelves, or do you have to be prescribed that?
There are one or two prescription ones, but the majority are over the counter because they're considered a nutrient rather than being a medical prescription. And with that, there are many, many over-the-counter ones. Still, a lot of work needs to be done with what's best for what child, because you probably need very tailored ones, but we're not that sophisticated yet.
Is there anything that parents need to look out for in the type they're buying? Does a certain bacteria need to be in there, or do they all have pretty much everything?
They all generally have much of a muchness. There are certain types of species that are probably better, but remember, it's tailoring. So your child may be missing certain types that are worth replacing. We're not really in the position of testing as a routine yet, although there are people doing testing. What is good and what is bad is still being worked out. But
so how do you know as a parent what to give?
No, well, that's the difficult. We don't yet. You should ask me this question in about 10 years. We'll be really knowing the answer.
So should
question.
You just try some different ones and see how your child...
Yeah, generally. Most people, having a probiotic has very, very few risks. If any, there is, you know, and most of the time the long-term benefits are going to be very, very big.
And are they sort of an oral suspension? Are they a liquid that you
Yeah,
give?
They're generally suspensions at the moment. Some people worry about because sometimes they're based in lactose-based formulas, but generally they're generally all pretty safe. Yeah.
And is there, if you're a mother who's breastfeeding, if you're taking probiotics following the birth, can that then go through to the baby, or is that just good for your gut and not for the babies?
The best pre and probiotic, and we'll talk about prebiotics shortly, is that the best probiotic you can give is breast milk. Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah, it contains all the right ingredients, and everything we're trying to do is copy it. Yeah, yeah, but we still don't understand so much about breastfeeding.
And it probably is tailored to our children.
Yeah, it
in
is.
A way we don't know yet.
For example, breast milk contains lots of lactose. Yeah, lactose generates good bacteria. That's called a prebiotic. And the influence of breast milk on your child, which is probably tailored to your child's need, because not all breast milk is equal, is going to generate the healthiest bacteria, the microbiome, for the future, for your child. And that's a tailored sort of...
And is there much data or have there been many studies into how long you breastfeed for and whether that makes much of a difference?
So we were designed to breastfeed till two. Yeah. The percentage of people who breastfeed to two is sadly very low. But we don't really know exactly how long, but the longer you breastfeed, the better. That's for certain.
Yeah. And probably the first 6 months is the most important till the child is on solids.
Absolutely.
Because realistically, breastfeeding till two for busy working mums is often just not possible. No. And you want to just get a happy medium that is good for your baby and good for you.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can get, I think it's amazing when a mum walks from my door and is breastfeeding to 6 months.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll always see me smile a lot and actually think, wow, fabulous. And I think, you know, that child's gut is going to be healthy because that's what the mum's done by breastfeeding. And then, you know, introducing solids will change that profile, but there couldn't be a better start.
And if there are again lots of reasons why mums can't breastfeed or or struggle to breastfeed, and what's the next best thing?
Okay, so if a child, when a mother can't breastfeed, it does happen. There are multiple reasons for doing that. Is that there are loads of our infant formulas that are designed to be as close as possible to breast milk. So there's no danger in doing that. It's safe, and people are beginning to strategize about using pre and probiotics.
Well, a lot of them have them in there now, don't they?
And they're built in there, and it's part and parcel of the role of those to mimic breast milk. So there's no harm in doing that. And actually, there's lots of gains in the infant formulas as well. So they're good alternatives.
Like the added vitamins and...
Yeah, so there's added sugars called GOS and FOS. These are the long doctor's names for them, and they're basically...
Good sugars.
They're good sugars, exactly. You have some specialist infant formulas that have probiotics built within them. There's one called Lactobacillus IgG that is added to an allergy milk. Mm. So that's... So those are specialist formulas. So they're generating sort of equivalents. Yeah, and they're all really good for you as well if you can't breastfeed.
Or if you've decided to stop at however many months down the line or weeks, and then just a good alternative.
Absolutely, yeah. Infant formulas are all designed to be appropriate and built for babies until at least the age of one. Mm.
Yeah. And has there been a lot of money and research and effort gone into creating infant formulas, or is it something that hasn't really evolved in the last... two decades?
I think there's an enormous amount of research that goes into infant formulas to be not only safe but to be appropriate for short and long-term well-being of your children, and the investment in research into it is enormous. But what they're doing is trying to mimic what breastfeeding does for you.
And there are so many different types of formulas on the market. And if your baby is well, or maybe just has a bit of colic, you know, there are all these anti-colic formulas and reflux formulas. Is there anything? Is that just marketing, or is that?
So I'm not. I don't prescribe any anti-reflux milks or formulas. I don't think they work. I think it's a transient phase. You need to recognise colic that isn't just colic, so can be mistaken for milk allergies and stuff. Mm. But most colic is transient, it's resolvable, and it's reassurance and time that will overcome that. No formula will overcome that.
Yeah. That's what we spend, I'm sure you and I both spend a lot of time talking to our patients about. But in a colic... Can you give us a description of you know, if a parent says to you, what is colic? Why is my baby crying? And it seems to be her tummy. Do we know?
So, well, colic's really interesting because it's really cultural. It depends which part of the world you're in, because people treat colic very differently and see. So British colic, if you like, is short-lived. It's increasing from the age of about 6 weeks. And then you'll see a peak, especially in the evening symptoms between 6 and 12, and then it will die off after about 12 weeks and babies begin to learn to sleep. So up until that point, you'll get a peak of colic and then it should settle.
And people want to treat it, don't they?
Yeah, they do want to treat it, and it's a normal event. Yeah. You know, don't get me wrong, I've had two boys who are really colicky and with milk allergies and all the rest of it, and both those boys didn't have colic, they just had misery. And that's very different from... colic, which usually just settles by itself, just with, you know, whichever calming technique.
And do you think it's just to do with the gut maturing and the baby's getting used to their gut, essentially?
So the gut, I mean, if you think about what you eat every day, you know, I think it's remarkable your gut doesn't react, because in the end you're throwing proteins, fats, carbs, bacteria. You know, we challenge our guts by going to nice restaurants and all the rest of it. Yet we're always amazed that our babies' guts that are completely immature, that are maturing with new barrier formation, new protective layers, that they don't react to the environment they're given. Mm. Yeah, and it's an adaptive phase, and we sort of think, oh, well, that's really abnormal. It's not. It's just an adaption into maturity.
So yeah. what are the other cultural colics? I'm interested.
So, yeah, so when you have people who... The people's response rates and reporting rate of colics are very, very different if you're Japanese, German, UK. So people swaddle their children for different amounts of time, leave their children to cry for different amounts of time. It depends on the way the families are brought up, and it's very interesting to see what different cultures will do.
And crying doesn't necessarily mean discomfort, and also doesn't necessarily mean illness.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, and sometimes it's a need. Yeah, you cry because their baby has a need, and it's just normal.
Yeah, and some babies just take longer to settle than others.
Yeah, they do.
What about the sort of over-the-counter things you buy for colic? Is there anything useful? Is there anything? So
there's products like Smefacone or Imficol, and these sort of trade name products, and they do work as a transient baby, and if it works, fine. Yeah, but don't expect it to work for very long. And the evidence is minor on them in terms of helping. But, at that time when you're exhausted and tired and it helps a little bit, so be it.
It's worth a go, isn't it? It's not going to do any harm. That's the important
exactly.
thing.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One of the questions we get asked a lot on the bump class is about babies' poos. In fact, we warn the girls that they're going to be talking a lot about what comes out the other end.
And Neil and I were just chatting about how many photos of poos generally we get sent by our patients doctors. So that's not
they
uncommon.
They have little albums of poo collections.
So what's normal with regard to babies' poos? In terms of frequency and consistency. I'm sorry to those of you listening, it's perhaps a bit distasteful, but it's important. You want to know, don't you?
So the first thing is, it depends how you're feeding your child. So if you're breastfeeding your child is healthy and well, it can be anything. If you're formula feeding, it's different. So we generally begin to look at, is the poo painful? Is it infrequent? Not just is it hard, because sometimes it can be soft with excessive straining. And if the child hasn't pooed every 3 days or less, once every fourth day or fifth day, then you begin to be suspicious. But if the child's absolutely well, then just ignore it.
I remember learning in medical school that you were told, if a breastfed baby who's well, anything between 7 times a day and once in 7 days is kind of considered normal.
My old professor used to say, you're allowed to poo if you're breastfed once every 13 days or 13 times. Times a day, so that's what he's
got. So
everyone has an anecdote about babies and breastfeeding.
But the message is, if your baby is well and thriving and doesn't seem to be uncomfortable, then that's completely fine. And in terms of consistency, I have a lot of patients talking about explosive poos and babies passing a lot of wind. And is that a problem?
So in terms of consistency, it can be a problem, but generally isn't. Because it depends on how quickly the food products are moving down your gut. Remember, poo's made up not only of food, it's made up of the lining of the bowel, it's made up of the bugs, the microbiome that we're just talking about, and it's consistency. Just think about yourselves. You're not the same consistency, colour or frequency every day. Why should your babies be? And imagine when you start weaning, the consistency dramatically changes, and that's normal. There are some things to look out for. Blood, obviously, is always a worry. Mucus, sometimes sometimes can be normal, but mainly it's an abnormal feature.
Yeah.
If your child's got a persistent nappy rash that isn't going away, that's different from a child who has a bit of redness around their bottom. So there are other clues. You never look at it in isolation. I sometimes worry if the poo is so watery that it's soaking right through the nappy. That's very different than
for a
poo.
Long time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's the persistence of these symptoms that make the difference.
No, I think you know, poo is a big chat when it comes to mothers with their babies, and it carries on.
Carries on for a lifetime around a dinner table.
So what about as they're getting onto solid food? You know, we talked about the importance of breast milk or probiotics in formula. You know, once they're off breast milk. But what about when we're starting to feed them solid foods? We've done podcasts on weaning, so we know that we start with the simple, you know, root vegetables and simple fruits and baby rice. But once we're starting to get a bit more diverse than that, is there anything we can do to improve our children's gut health in terms of what we're giving them?
So everything you eat should be in balance, but it's just the variety. It's keeping it variety, keeping things balanced and in proportion. Obviously, fresher and healthier is always going to be better than something that's processed through.
Does when we start weaning? I know there's a big impact on early weaning and allergy, generally speaking. So a lot of the allergists are saying if you start closer to 4 months than 6 months, that can be better. But what about in terms of the gut health?
So most of us will still follow the World Health Organization's criteria around 6 months. And that's generally what I follow. I think there are some bits of evidence around children with eczema who have peanut allergy risks and egg allergy risks that you might be able to diminish those. But the argument's raging at the moment about when you should be weaning, and it's still not certain.
It's still not clear.
I'm not a fan of a child with lots of symptoms early weaning. I don't think that generally works, because what you want is the gut settled and stable. So anywhere between, the arguments range between 4 and 6 months. Generally, I will wean between 5 and 6 months.
Five and six sort of suits most people, and maybe seem to be ready at that point.
And people are starting to prepare to go back to work.
And then once they're on a more diverse, we know that, or there is talk that fermented foods are good for the gut. Is that right?
So I mean,
getting children to eat fermented foods is going to be a bit difficult. But
I can't even smell kimchi.
Oh, that's the most disgusting thing we've ever smelled.
So when you look at fermented foods, I come from a culture that if you're unwell, fermenting stuff is actually what you do to recover your children. And actually, there is probably some evidence around it. I'm not an expert in this area, but in terms of that, one, you have to get the kids to eat the stuff, and the second thing is that it probably has some evidence behind it, but I don't know. I really don't
know. So a varied diet is what you're saying. I mean, what about vegetarian, veganism? How often should we? I know we talked briefly about this before, but meat in the diet is generally, it's good for some things nutritionally, but is it very important? Is it very bad for you?
So I was saying to you guys earlier that I'm vegetarian, and the dramatic changes between vegetarian and eating are quite dramatic.
In terms of
gut health, gut microbiome, bacterial flora, it's one of the most dramatic things you can do to your gut.
And if you go from eating meat to becoming a vegetarian, does that still change your gut?
It does, as long as you stay in balance and you stay healthy. And see, if you're going to be vegan, then equally you can stay more than healthy. But you have to work harder at the balance, to get the right balance between proteins, carbs and fats and micronutrients and nutrients. So it's all about getting everything in proportion.
And probably when you look at the research and meat, a few times a week actually is probably more than enough. And certainly I say to my patients, you certainly don't need more than one meal a day with a meat or fish in it. But it's a cultural thing, isn't it? A lot of people just eat it with every meal. That's not necessarily a good thing.
I remember thinking that my children needed to have meat every day, at least once a day, to sort of build their protein levels. But
I think it's what the most amazing thing to watch is the change in patterning of eating in terms of people becoming vegetarians or vegans across Europe. It's dramatic. And it's actually interesting because I'm now being asked quite a lot in clinics about, can my child be this? Can my child be vegetarian? Can they be
vegan?
Is it
healthy?
Is it healthy?
What about intolerances? I mean, it's something I'm sure you see a lot of in clinic. I certainly have conversations a lot about it. It seems to be quite common nowadays. You know, I don't know if a lot of parents are sort of diagnosing it themselves. Sometimes doctors might be diagnosing it more. We know that cow's milk protein intolerance is quite closely linked to the refluxy symptoms that babies can get. But are there other intolerances that people should look out for, or is this just a fad?
So some of it's real, some of it is faddy, and some of it is increasing. So there's a spectrum. So the real stuff is where there's a symptom group that goes together. So the children feel unwell, their back arching, stiffening. It's what people call silent reflux. They're pooing differently. They're
crying a lot.
Crying, and they're irritable. Their stools are different. That's very different. So that's what people call cow's milk protein intolerances. Mm. As you get older, gluten sensitivity seems to be increasing. Mm. You know, remember, there are 1 in 100 people in the UK who are European in extraction will have celiacs.
Yeah.
But also, there's a lot of people where we've stopped hunting, if you like, and started gathering through wheat and stuff. Those environments are where gluten sensitivity is rocketing. Yeah, and we are saying, and it's a genuine condition, gluten sensitivity.
So these are people who are not celiac, they don't have celiac disease, but they are very sensitive.
They clearly show sensitivity to gluten.
And children.
Yeah, and children can do it as well. And then you get the other group who are just doing it because they think it's better for them. Yeah, and that's where the waters get really muddied, because you don't really know how to separate some of those groups out. And trying to convince families to put it back into your diet and then challenge the children with these foods is based on what the families believe as well.
So taking something out of the child's diet, be it milk or gluten, for example, is not a good idea unless your child has symptoms of something that is related.
So I think you should never take a good, important food group out unless you've got one medical direction in doing it and there's good reason to do it. And not only do you test those reasons, you would want to retest that, as long as it's safe, by reintroducing it to make sure those symptoms are not just accidental.
And also because children do grow out of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So the most, what people call intolerances or delayed allergies, most children will grow out of it, but it's not quite what people think. So people think, like, milk allergy, for example, grows out of it at the age of one. Most children will grow out in the second and third year of life, so it's slightly more protracted than people realise.
But if your child's been diagnosed with a cow's milk protein intolerance as a baby, that doesn't mean they're never going to be able to drink milk, does it?
Not at all. Yeah, and so a lot of children will recover and become absolutely normal. And we hardly see, Cara, when you send me patients, I hardly see them after the age of one, because most of them are managing beautifully and they're doing really well.
Yeah. And is that the same with gluten intolerance?
Gluten's slightly different, because gluten can be quite longer lived. Yeah, you see it in older children. Yeah. It can be associated with things like irritable bowels and stuff. Mm. Yeah, it can be sort of a driver of the gut becoming irritated, and it can be quite long lived. It's more common as you get older. Mm. Yeah. And see, so yeah, gluten intolerance is interesting because it's rising. Yeah.
And in terms of testing for it, talk us through that.
So if we deal with gluten, Gluten is basically a case of not taking anything out unless you've made sure that your child has or has not celiac disease, because once you've taken the gluten out, we won't know.
Yeah, the tests come back.
Yeah, they come back negative because you've treated yourself. And then once you're sure it's not celiac disease and you're sure your child's got symptoms, you take it out of your diet. It takes anywhere around 2 to 4 weeks, and then you should re-challenge it, and the symptoms should reproducibly recur. Yeah.
And re-challenging means introducing.
Yeah, reintroducing it back into your child's diet. And because there's so many coincidental things that can look like colic, can look like tummy aches and pains, and actually you need to be careful not to take major food groups out without good, sound evidence.
Yeah, and then also if you do, having the input of a dietitian or someone who can really help you make sure your child's getting a balanced diet is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I work with some amazing dietitians, some of the best in the world, I think, and those, they're really, really key to ensuring good nutritional safety, especially if your child has to have a food group removed from their diet. Mm.
But there's not a sort of magic blood test or magic stool test that's going to tell you about these intolerances, is there?
No, I mean, especially if you take cow's milk allergy, which is delayed and affecting the gut, the holy grail, everyone's looking for a test that's reliable.
Yeah,
sometimes the testing can guide you a little bit, but generally everyone's looking for a test that's reliable.
And if we're talking about milk, nutritionally, is there a big difference between cow's milk and goat's milk, for example? Or I have a lot of patients who are saying to me, should I just be giving my child goat's milk formula rather than cow's milk, just because isn't it more healthy? What's your view on that?
So if a child's tolerant of, say they were on infant formula and they're tolerant of a cow's milk formula, I would never recommend them to go on anything else. Yeah.
Because?
Because there's so much overlap and there's no advantage. Yeah. So anything from four legs, the protein of cow's milk is very similar to goat's milk, about 96%. If you take sheep's milk, it's 86% similar. So you're just giving them the same product, more or less. Yeah. Mm. And see. So.
But is it nutritionally less good?
So they've been better in the last few years. That most of these companies are now fortified them, yeah. And so they are just as good as the infant formulas. Yeah. But they're, you know, but there's no logical reason to go on to these formulas. Yeah. You know, if your child needs an alternative formula, then think about why. But yeah. Generally, stick with cow's milk based formulas because they're just as good.
And then, if they do need a different formula, they should be seeing a doctor for it.
Yeah, I generally think I always feel very uncomfortable when someone comes into the office and into the clinic and says, "Well, my child's on goat's milk and they're better." And yeah. And then generally, I think that's fatty rather than actually being a disease base.
Yeah. And what about when your child's older and drinking milk as a drink or on their cereal? Is there any benefit to not, you know, having a goat over cow or even using almond milk instead of...
Yeah, the plant-based milks.
So there's things to think about. So what the advantage of cow's milk is calcium, but also iodine, because these are the things that are fortified or added or high in content in cow's milk. So if you're restricting cow's milk because you're using an over-the-counter formula, be careful because you're going to be losing key nutrients in your diet. Yeah, and again, you have to have a good reason to do that. Yeah, there's no reason to switch to the over-the-counter formulas unless there's a medical reason to do it. So, but those are improving. You know, the plant-based formulas. Yeah, and be wary of soya because soya cross-reacts with dairy, so you have to be careful of soya. But the others, yeah, they are fortified with calcium. Some of them. And see, but it's some
but
of that
the actual drinks or the actual kind of the actual milk when it's fresh, when they're older, is there a benefit or is there any difference? Or do they get? I mean, nutritionally, cow's milk is actually very good.
Yeah,
you can tolerate it.
So, I mean, again, you go back to just in terms of the other over-the-counter formulas, and now nutritionally, they're not as wholesome. They contain very little protein, sugar content's different, and they're not. They're drinks more rather than formulas, really. Because they don't contain...
Which one?
Any of them. So, you know, if you got hazelnut, almond, oat, those kind of ones are plant-based. Mm. Yeah, they're nutritionally not complete, so you shouldn't be using them in very young children.
Yeah.
After the age of two, it's not so dependent. We don't drink a lot of milk in our diet. We have it on our cereals. We might have the odd drink with it, and it's not a major factor in our diet.
So it doesn't really matter
At that age, but it does matter if you're an infant, especially don't do it under one. Yeah, that you have to do with medical guidance.
That's really interesting. What about things like sugars, again, for older children? You know, we're constantly talking about sugars being bad for us, but there's lots of good sugars, aren't there, that children need to have that are important for gut health?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to balance here because everyone gets really worked up about sugars. And yeah, refined sugars have a problem if you have them in excess, but we have sugars because they're good for you in the right proportions. And so, you know, and equally, some of the sugars that we have in our diet, like lactose, for example, that everyone worries about, is lactose is one of the best generators of good bacteria in your gut. It has a big prebiotic effect. And why we restrict it without good reason... Yeah. I can't drink lactose because I'm Indian and I have an 80% chance that I will be lactose intolerant because my genetics determine that. Yeah? And that's true for lots of races. But if you don't have that problem, then don't take it out of your diet because it's good for you. Yeah.
And babies and lactose intolerance?
So I have an easy rule. I never want to see lactose intolerance diagnosed in an under one unless it's post-infection. It does not exist except in a tiny bit of Latvia and a tiny bit of Finland. And I've never seen it. I work in a rare diseases hospital and I've never, ever seen lactose intolerance as a primary diagnosis.
In a baby under one.
And the other confusion is lacto-free formulas have cow's milk base, but no lactose in it. So they are not suitable for cow's milk allergy. So GPs, parents, lots of people confuse lactose intolerance. So do paediatricians. Yeah. So they are not the same thing. One is a sugar, one is a protein.
What, so lactose intolerance and cow's milk protein intolerance?
Yeah.
Two so
it's
completely
a
different
big,
things. Yeah.
Big difference. And don't diagnose it until under the age of one. It doesn't exist.
I mean, I have read that sugar is really bad for your gut, and I've obviously seen people sort of take it to the extreme and not let kids eat tomatoes because they've got a high sugar content. Yeah. Where's the sort of boundary? I mean, there's a very different to kind of feeding your kids Haribo every afternoon to not letting them have tomatoes.
So you know
on
my
the side.
Kids then. So no, but in terms of so again, if you look at some non-processed, some sugars actually. So I'll say, let's take artificial sweeteners.
Yeah? Yeah.
Artificial sweeteners are generally bad for you. They give you bad bacterial profiles. We use a lot of them. Yeah, yeah.
And they are in a lot of processed foods,
aren't
they?
In a lot of processed foods, and they generate bad microbiome for you. So they're not good for you in large amounts. Yeah. Natural sugars, again, in proportion. Perfect for you. They will generate good bacteria, good healthy gut. You'll absorb them. You know, you have to brush your teeth, obviously. But apart from that, yeah, they're not bad for you.
So we're talking grapes here, or are we talking kind of natural cane sugar?
We're talking grapes. There's lots of fads about new sugars around and about at the moment. And when the jury's out of whether that makes a difference or not, I don't think we know yet.
Yeah. Just feels better because it's more expensive.
It probably does. So.
Fibre, that's the other thing that people talk a lot about. Do you need to be giving your children fibre, or do they have enough of it anyway?
So the UK population probably drinks plenty of fibre, eats plenty of fibre in their diets. Yeah. And when we have fibre, it's balanced, you know, it's there to bulk and help transit of poo through your bowel. It generates good bacteria because it's a pre and probiotic effect. So generally fibre in balance and having a normal diet will be perfect. You don't have to add excess fibre. And just a word on constipation, there is a lot of people who give lots of water and lots of extra fibre to their children because their children are constipated. It doesn't make a blind bit of difference.
So what does when your child is constipated?
So a lot of constipation is based around the behaviour of toileting. Yeah, and it has very, very little to do what you're feeding your children. Some children need medicines, but the majority, it's around your child's toileting behaviour.
And that's because they are a bit anxious about
opening the bowels?
A whole host
of things. You know, it could be simple as basically they've had an episode of painful pooing and they're scared. Yeah, because it is very painful to, you know, if you had blood in the stools because of something called a fissure. Yeah, it's exquisitely painful and they get scared. Yeah, and if the stools still remain hard, they will not want to poo and they'll retain it.
And the longer you hold it, the harder it gets.
Yeah. And it's just a vicious cycle.
Does it help giving them a bit of lactulose just to kind of soften it up and make it a bit easier?
Only if you need to, because actually, if you want to get them over the hump of having painful pooing because it's hard, the initial bit works really, really well. Yeah. And then it's just getting them into regular toileting patterns.
Yeah. So. But they can, and there are certain things they can eat that can help, you know, I mean, prunes and...
Yeah, prunes are fabulous. Yeah. If you go back to what grandmum used to use, it works really, really well. They're great stimulators.
Works better than prune juice, I think, because you've got the fibre of the prunes. Yeah,
and kids like them because they're absolutely... They taste really sweet. So natural remedies work just as well. And, you know.
Yeah, definitely getting that. And that must be something you see quite commonly.
Yeah, I see it a lot in the babies, actually, because obviously no one wants to give their child a medicine unless they have to. And actually using natural remedies, you know, prune juice is what they use because it's sweet. The babies really like the taste and it does work. It's a good stimulating laxative.
And it's not a medicine, like you
say.
So what else do you see in your clinics that could perhaps you might not need to have seen? You know, what could parents do for things like if your child is getting tummy aches a lot? It's really common in children, isn't it? When do you need to worry, or is that something you don't need to really worry much
about? So belly aches is one, they're common, and one is not to panic, and reassurance works wonders for most of the children. But there are some red flags that you would look for. So red flags like weight loss. A child who wakes up in the middle of the night with belly aches, I don't mean as they go off to sleep, but when they're fast asleep and they're suddenly waking their mum and dad up because they've got pain. A child who toilets overnight, poos overnight is a worry, because that's not normal at all. Once they're out of nappies and see. And then children who have, you know, change in bowel habit with bellyache, that's different. And then you start becoming suspicious that something's going on. So
but if a child's well and their bowel habit is normal and they're just complaining of tummy ache, I mean, my experience, the most common reason is anxiety. They're reflecting their anxiety through their tummy ache, essentially.
Yeah, so if you, lots and lots of children will present themselves with bellyache because if you imagine you have butterflies in your stomach and it's 100 times worse, then it's painful.
Interesting, I was talking to a psychotherapist the other day and she was saying, we're talking about kind of grief and pain and bereavement. She said children tend to feel their emotions very physically.
Yeah.
So you'll often get a child that's, you know, sad, and they get physical manifestation of that yeah. much more than we do as adults.
I mean, gastroenterologists will talk a lot about big brain, the one in your head, and you have almost as many nerves in your gut as in your head. Yeah. And that big brain, little brain axis between your head and the gut is key.
Yeah.
Yeah, for example, when I do big lectures and I lecture all over the world, if I'm speaking to peers that are very similar level to me, I get bad reflux because I'm anxious.
Yeah.
And that's a physical symptom.
Well, and if you have a 20 or 30 11-year-olds lining up for an exam, outside exam hall, I mean, a quarter of them will probably rush and have diarrhea. That's not because they've got a problem with their bowels, it's because they're nervous.
I think it's hysterical. One, a couple of my colleagues, one in particular I'm thinking of at the moment, that every time we do lectures together, so he'll do allergy, I'll do gastro and the gastroallergy, 2 minutes before his lecture, he's in the loo, and I'm just looking around thinking, where is he? So, yeah, and he's running off to the loo, and I've got reflux. It's a great combination, isn't
but
it?
But there's nothing wrong with
either. No, absolutely. There's nothing wrong with us. That's big brain, little brain.
We're recording this in November as we get into the sort of sick bug season where there's gastroenteritis around. Obviously, this is sort of part and parcel of having young children, and we kind of need to accept it. But is there anything that we can do for our children after a nasty bout of the sick bug that will kind of help restore their gut?
Which often happens, you know, the whole family will then get it, won't they? Yeah. 'Cause it spreads so quickly.
So in terms of bugs and stuff, usually you allow up to 2 weeks for your gut to settle.
Mm.
Yeah, your gut should recover after 2 weeks. Some people are unlucky enough that it becomes protracted and lasts longer. Things that will cause that are things like lactose. Yeah, so your gut suddenly becomes unable to absorb lactose, and that inability to absorb lactose means that people can restrict lactose or even milk afterwards. Because
so that can help.
That can help.
So restricting milky products or milk after a bug,
And then probiotics are a good strategy, because probiotics will help rebuild your barriers in your gut and just help the immune system to boost within your gut. So there's lots of little tricks like that.
Mm.
Yeah. And yeah.
What about the types of food that it was worth?
It's very much try it and see, because lots of children, lots of adults and children will have some foods that they just don't tolerate as well than others. So there's no specific food that generally helps. And see, and it depends on food groups that you may have sort of.
And people say bland food, and
absolutely.
And that does make a difference. Yeah. I think if you're having spicy food or really acidy food, or that can be hard. Whereas if you're just having plain rice and a bit of broth, then that.
Yeah,
it's
no. So certainly in the first 2 weeks, keeping things simple is absolutely key. Just allowing your gut time to recover.
And if your child is like really doesn't want to eat vegetables and fruit in that period, is that the end of the world, or you just let them get on with it?
Yeah, sometimes give them a break, and that's a good 2 weeks to give them a break.
We
give
our kids presumably then too, you know, you can give your children some multivitamin, and then we know that they're getting vitamin C at least.
Multivitamins, there's a lot of rebirth about certain kinds of vitamins and balanced vitamins. You know, vitamin D has had a massive rebirth because it's just really good for you. Multivitamins in that phase, and just allowing your child to recover and not pushing foods that they won't eat, because when we don't feed well, what do? We don't eat.
Exactly.
And then we try and make our children and force our children to eat things. When they're not well, they'll eat them when they're having. Yeah. Of course,
my children don't eat when they are well. They don't really. They're not that bothered about food.
that's just.
They've been ill and they've had been prescribed antibiotics. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about antibiotics, but we know that they're useful, when they're really needed. But they kill the good bacteria as well as the bad bacteria. So, is it really important to take probiotics?
Yeah,
when you're on antibiotics?
I think there's going to be an interesting sort of strategy about what we do with antibiotics and the timing. So you finish your course, and using probiotics afterwards is probably going to help accelerate recovery.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So not at the same time, it's after you've finished your antibiotics.
No, because most of your probiotics are liable to be killed by the antibiotic you're giving.
Yeah.
So you might as well just wait that time. And you're changing the flora of the gut bugs dramatically by the antibiotic. And then you want to wait till that settles and then reintroduce them.
And when you're choosing a probiotic, you obviously get a sort of spectrum of price ranges. Is it good to go for the most expensive, or are they kind of all the same?
I would look at
how many colony units, so they call them colony units, so how much bugs are in there.
The diversity of bugs
is the second thing. Yeah, and you see you're looking, and all of them will have a range that is very similar names, actually. You'll find that they're all just combined slightly differently. And seeing it's not just about cost, it's about just looking at a range and something your child will take and it's pleasant for them.
So even though reading the label of the probiotics to me looks like total gobbledygook, it's just the more gobbledygook there is and the higher numbers associated are the better ones. Is that is that good advice?
Do you know, we're going to try that tomorrow to see what happens. So, I've got to pick my son up later. I'm going to just give him a probiotic bottle and say, what do you think of this? And then he's going to memorial just squirm and say, no, I just don't have any idea what that is. And I'll try
that.
That's
a good test.
Yeah, I'll try that as a test.
So we were talking right at the beginning about how important the first 1,000 days of a child's life is. And we're talking from conception, really, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
To the second birthday. In terms of influencing their gut microbiome and their sort of profile of gut bacteria, presumably you can still change it after two. It's not that, parents listening to this who've got children who are a bit older who think, oh my goodness, I didn't do any of this. Can they do anything now?
No, it's never too late, because in the end, as I said, if you change your diet by what you're eating from vegetarian to meat eating or vice versa, that's a dramatic change. Using probiotics is a dramatic change. Yeah, the main impact when your gut's most immature is between up until two, but your gut's still adapting and maturing. Mm. And when it gets an attack, so gastroenteritis or a bug, recovering it properly is going to help. Yeah. Mm. So no, it's never too late. So, my parents were in their 70s and 80s, and I make them take probiotics because, I want them to age well.
Are probiotics, does everyone in your house take probiotics?
They do.
All the time?
I'm a constant probiotic. We travel a lot as well, so the other evidence is that if you travel, to reduce the number of gut bugs and upset tummies you get, is probiotics are really good for you. So we have a family sort of probiotic pot that we take.
So. Are your children on board with it, or are they like, oh, he's not looking, we've got away with it?
Do you know, children are children, and trying to get compliance on anything in children is a nightmare. So I think the problem is you can't slip it into hot food. So when they order the pizzas and they want to slip it onto the pizza, you can't, because they'll be killed by the hot pizza.
Oh, really?
So you have to be really careful.
So you shouldn't take your probiotics with a hot cup of tea?
No, because you'll kill them there. They live at body temperature.
Yeah,
and so you can't overheat them.
Yeah. And you shouldn't keep them in the fridge?
So some are stored in the fridge and some aren't. You just have to look at what the storage instructions are, because they're not all equal. So
even if you've got a really good diet, healthy, varied diet, it's worth taking. You think it's worth taking a probiotic?
I do. I think the next few years are going to be really exciting, because we're going to be tailoring probiotics. Unfortunately, some people have patented your poo, because people have started identifying really good probiotic bugs and started saying, well, that's really good, and we're going to put them into studies, and that's going to happen in the next few years. But I think most of us will be adding probiotics into most medical therapies we give you. So the answer is yes, I think they're good things.
And you can't OD on probiotics. I mean, obviously, if you'd like to obviously drink the whole packet, then that's not good. But
that'd be a medical first, wouldn't it, to OD on probiotics? No, I haven't seen it yet. No,
and you mentioned a few times prebiotics. Just explain to listeners what that means.
So prebiotics are like good sugars. Yeah. So the explosion of knowledge comes from breast milk, which contains some natural prebiotics, and those natural prebiotics generate good bacteria.
So they're kind of like a fertilizer for your good bacteria.
They are, basically.
You've already got. It's not, whereas probiotics, so you don't have them.
If you've added a fertilizer onto some soil and then it suddenly rains very heavily, then it washes away. You have to be careful with prebiotics, because they're not as reliable as probiotics. So, for example, if you've got very rapid loose stools and you're using prebiotics, they're not going to sit there for long enough to grow. So there's, so probiotics are really key, but it has a lot more variability. Yeah. And do you need pre and probiotics together? Probably, because breast milk has it, you probably do, but we don't really know. So it's another area.
Your family take pre and probiotics?
No, they just take probiotics, actually, because I haven't quite worked. I've got my head around all the ins and outs. And prebiotics are fabulous for you. They're really good for you. Yeah. But, the ins and outs of it, I think they're more tricky, actually.
It would be really interesting. I mean, I'm totally convinced now about sort of gut health and probiotics in terms of adults, because, parents, I think, often feel really depleted by childbirth and looking after children. I mean, I've never been more exhausted and wrecked in my life as since having children. Is there anything that we can do as grown-ups? I mean, I know this isn't your speciality, but is there anything that we can do, something simple that will sort of ensure that, I mean, you're talking about your parents and how you want them to have good gut health and how important that is in the long term. Is there something quick and easy we can do that will be good for our gut health?
Take probiotics.
Do you know, in a word, yeah, exactly that. Because in the end, if you're going to sit there and improve your general health as well, you know, everyone will look at their balanced diets, everyone's looking at that, everyone's looking about the components, you know, and if you need multivitamins and you need supplementation, then you need it. However, using probiotics is the other thing you can do to yourself that's healthy, safe, and will help you, not your short-term, but your long-term health as well. So,
and I don't think I'm the only mother in the world who sort of waits for 7 o'clock and the kids have gone to bed and then reaches for a glass of wine. Is alcohol really bad for your gut health, or is it not?
I'm going to say absolutely not. It's great for you.
Well, it's a fermented food, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, a glass of wine after a hard day, perfect.
One question, just before we finish, people will often say to me, "Well, how do I know what my gut flora is like? Can I test for it? Is there a sort of, is there a lab that I can send my stool to?" And I know theoretically it's possible. You know, we can look and see what the bacteria that are in our stool. You know, what is there? But there are quite a lot of complementary therapists who also send off these stool tests, and I never know quite whether you can interpret them.
So, I mean, there are a lot of private facilities around testing labs that will look at microbiome. Yeah, and there are different levels of sophistication for microbiome. We don't offer it as a routine test at all because we don't understand what the results mean. And that's our big problem. However, you know, there will become testing on a more routine basis.
Yeah. And when you say we don't understand what the results mean, that's no one understands what the results mean.
Yeah. And it depends what you're doing. Whether, for example, if you look at sportsmen or sportswomen, if you look at sports people who are having a microbiome, you know, a fit, healthy person will have a very different microbiome because of the type of activities they do compared to someone else who doesn't. Disease, you know, in disease states, so I look after a condition called Crohn's disease. In Crohn's disease, it's very clear the microbiome skews to a very bad microbiome. So we don't really know disease and health and what's perfect. And remember, you're tailoring it to individuals. We've got a long way to go. So I'm not a fan when a parent will bring a whole microbiome screen on their babies because we don't really understand the ins and outs of balance.
Presumably, the only thing you can see is it varied? Are there lots of bacteria in there? And if so, that's quite a good thing. But so, what the actual numbers are and where those cutoffs are, we don't understand yet.
No, not yet. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's far, but I think we're still on a discovery. We're still on a journey and we're not there yet. Yeah.
And it's going to change in the next 10 years a lot.
I think you cannot go to a medical conference now in gastro and gastroenterology without someone talking about microbiome throughout the whole day. Yeah. Someone will mention it no matter what you're doing.
Yeah. And that's changed. Changed,
do you know, in the last 10 years, no one mentioned it. Now everyone mentions it. Yeah.
Well, Neil, this has been so illuminated. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Welcome.
Really great. Chiara, thank you for thinking of all the clever questions to ask. And thank you all for downloading another episode of the Parenthood Podcast. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review us. And if you're enjoying the other episodes, don't forget to spread the word amongst your friends. The more listeners we have, the more episodes we can record. You can also follow us on Instagram. We're at theparent.hood, or follow me at marina.fogel. We love your suggestions for new podcasts, so please do get in touch with us on Instagram. But in the meantime, from Neil, Chiara and me, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.